Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John List, a professor of economics and chairman of the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago. He's been a research associate at the National Bureau of Economics for more than a decade and served as senior economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors for Environmental Resource Economics. He's also co-author of the new book just out, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Welcome to Background Briefing, John List.
Ian, thanks for having me.
And you're a behavioral economist, and you seem to have merged economics and anthropology here in the research for your new book, The Y-Axis. And in your book, you reveal, I'll just quickly read some of the things, which individually are fairly earth-shattering, not to mention collectively. You reveal ways to close the gap between rich and poor students, to stop the violence plaguing inner-city schools, to decipher whether women are really less competitive than men, to correctly price products and services, and to discover the real reasons why people discriminate. So that's the ultimate Gordian knot there that you've untied. I mean, I'm very impressed.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, at the end of the day, I'm just an economist. I like to go out into the real world. I like to use scientific tools, and I like to learn about what motivates people to behave as they do.
And, of course, economics in its foundation with Adam Smith, who was a social philosopher, was, of course, connected to everyday life. And it seems to have drifted off over the years and more recently with the sort of numbers crunchers like Milton Friedman and the Ayn Rand incomprehensible acolyte of this Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan. So are you sort of bringing economics back to its more human roots?
You know, I think that's a good observation, Ian. When you look back at the fathers of economics, people like Adam Smith, you're exactly right. They would go out to a pin factory and they would observe workers in their real environments and they would try to figure out what's motivating those workers and what can we do to make those workers better off. And then economics went through a period, a very long period, where mathematical models began to rule the day. And I think my research begins to bring us back to the roots of economics, to not only look at behavioral economics, but to use approaches that are popular in anthropology and approaches that are popular in psychology to learn about exactly what does motivate people in their real environments.
And you went all around the country and all around the world, from the foothills of Kilimanjaro to California wineries, northern India to Chicago, of course, where you are. Now, since you went to the California wineries, and we're speaking to you from California, one of the things that you discovered, and we'll go through some of them, this is relatively trivial compared to some of the bigger questions that you answer here, but I was curious, since I like wine, that you discovered that a small vintner in California discovered that doubling the price of its Cabernet Sauvignon actually increased demand for the wine. Was the wine any good?
Yeah. It was excellent. You know, wine is a really interesting good. So, like you, I'm a wine connoisseur. But what's interesting about wine is that many times people look at the price of the wine and they infer the quality of the wine from that price. So when we talk to vineyards and folks that are actually retailing wine, what we ask them is we say, you know, how did you determine how high to set the price for your wine? And very few of them have actually experimented with lowering or raising the price. So when we go in with our tools to figure out exactly whether they should be raising or lowering the price or keeping it the same, in many cases with wine, what we find is that if you raise price a little bit, in the case that you mentioned, we doubled price, you know, you can actually not only make more money, but in some cases, you can actually sell more wine.
So in terms of the first couple of things I mentioned, and, you know, you deal with students and you say that some of your anthropological / economic experiments that are in your new book, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life, that there are ways to close the gap between rich and poor students. We know that the student debt problem has exploded in the last few years, and that student debt is now greater than household debt in the United States. So this is something that I think a lot of our listeners are very, very concerned about. So what does your research find to reveal ways to close that gap?
So about 5 years ago, I became interested in education and how we can close the stubborn gap between white students and minority students. What you find is year after year, white students outperform minority students by quite a large gap, and it's really hard to get rid of that gap. Now, what we did is we went back to the roots of education, and we set up our own preschools here in Chicago, and we set up two preschools to look at exactly what we should be doing for kids ages 3, 4, and 5 to close the racial achievement gap. Now, 4 years later, here we are, and what we figured out is that within 3 months, now I'm talking about within 90 days, we can just about completely close the racial achievement gap by using the correct mix of what's called a parent academy, which is we directly teach the parent how to teach his or her child, and we also directly treat the child ourselves with, say, 3 or 4 hours every morning, Monday through Friday, with a curriculum that very importantly teaches kids what are called non-cognitive skills, or skills like patience or perseverance. What we find is that if you have the really good mix of a parent academy with a good curriculum where we teach kids, we can considerably close a racial achievement gap within 3 months.
Again, I'm speaking with John List, professor of economics and chairman of the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago. He's been a research associate at the National Bureau of Economics and for more than a decade served as senior economist on the President's Council on Economic Advisors for Environmental Resource Economics. He is the co-author of the new book just out, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. Now, Chicago, of course, is probably the most violence plague in a city, has the most violence plagued in a city of any place in America, and the bloodletting continues. And you have found ways to stop this violence?
Yeah, you're exactly right. When you look at the teen violence here in Chicago, it is it's very disturbing. We have kids, you know, when we first started the research, there was a Chicago Public Schools student shot nearly every day here in Chicago. So I began working with the chief executive officer from the Chicago Public Schools to think about ways to lower the teen gun violence that we observe here in Chicago. And when you take on a chore like that, your first job is you have to figure out which are the kids most at risk. So we took mounds and mounds of data from Chicago Public Schools, and we beat up those data to come up with a risk measure for each child in Chicago Public Schools. And we can detail now which kids are most likely to be victims of gun violence. And from there, we go in with interventions to try to help those kids, because many of those kids who are victims of gun violence also happen to be those kids who are doing the shooting themselves. So now we have gone in with an agency from Pennsylvania called YAP, and we have treated hundreds of kids to get them off the streets, get them involved in productive activities, and we have not only lowered the gun violence, but we have also, importantly, kept many of these kids in school, because when you look at the dropout rate, for every 100 of these kids that enters the ninth grade, you know, only about 45 of them end up making it out with a high school diploma. So our program is not only about stopping youth gun violence, but it's also about keeping kids in school so they can be productive members of society for decades to come. And we talk about that study in the book, The Y-Axis.
So, but you also point out in your book, The Y-Axis, that in spite of the fact that the United States spends far more on public education than most other developed countries, the high school dropout rate is higher than 50% in some places. So what do you attribute that to?
You know, we're funneling billions and billions of dollars into public education, yet we still haven't quite gotten it right. And I think the main reason why is because we have not executed or conducted field experiments in schools. So what we should be doing in our public schools is we should not only be using our schools to teach our kids, but we should be using our schools to teach ourselves what works and why. In the moment we begin to have that cultural revolution to use schools to teach ourselves, we will then begin to learn about what works and why, and we will be able to take on this education problem that we have all around the U.S. and defeat it and move the U.S. to the point where we really need to be. We need to be leaders of public education, not laggards. And we can do that if we use every school district as a laboratory of innovation. And each time we have a major project, that we treat it like a scientific experiment, then we can learn exactly what works and why, and we can turn around this education problem.
So in other words, you're saying that we should have more pragmatic and experimental approaches to all of these questions as opposed to the ideological approaches that tend to create the legislations that, you know, that cause the mess that we're in, right?
Absolutely, Ian. So you've hit the nail on the head. Right now we have decision makers making important decisions based on anecdotes and rules of thumb. And we need to step back and say, look, we need real empirical evidence. We need real data that will drive informed decision making. And until we have that, all we will be doing is guessing. We'll be guessing what works and why, without the available evidence at hand. So that's exactly what I'm calling for. I'm calling for a data revolution, and that will be led by field experiments in the classroom.
And because, you know, there's a certain amount of meddling going on in education now. A lot of billionaires are getting in on the act. And I spoke recently with Diane Ravitch, who was Deputy Secretary of Education under the first President Bush and was largely responsible for the No Child Left Behind experiments that she's now repudiated. And her complaint was that, you know, public school has been denigrated unnecessarily and that these miracle schools and charter schools that have been cropping up here aren't necessarily the answer. And it would seem that rather than deal with the egos of billionaires, if they had your methodology and their money, we'd be getting somewhere.
You know, given the vast amount of resources that we spend every year in public education, if each time we have a new initiative, if we just had a treatment group and a control group so we would know exactly what that new initiative does, then we would finally learn something about exactly the educational principles that we need to understand to move our test scores and move our children to be better better equipped for today's modern world.
Without the disaster of, you know, innovation that is destructive, you know, just for the sake of innovation. Now, there was a recent, I think it was a Pew poll that indicated that over 40% of American households, the woman is now the primary breadwinner. And that's a big change. So you have this amazing change sociologically where women are more and more the breadwinners and heads of households, in effect, yet the glass ceiling is still intact in the big corporations. So there's a disparity there. But some of the research that you've discovered explains what? Why women are less competitive than men?
Yeah, exactly. You know, women have made a tremendous number of gains in the labor market, but your point is exactly spot on. When you look at the best levels or the highest paying jobs in our economy, those jobs are still dominated by men. So as an economist, I step back and say, you know, why is that the case? And people have now come forth arguing that it might be true that women are just less competitively inclined than men. So when there's a promotion to be had or when there's a raise to be had, you know, whereas men will be the first in line, women will actually be much less reserved in chiming in and saying, look, I deserve that promotion or I deserve that pay raise. So then we asked ourselves, you know, if that's true in the Western world, why is that the case? Is it nature or is it nurture? So we literally went to the end of the earth when we went to India and we visited a matrilineal society called the Kasi Society, and that's up in the northern part of India near a very large city called Shillong. So what you have here is a society where women essentially are running the village. If you have wealth that needs to be allocated or inheritance that needs to be passed along, all of the wealth will run through the youngest female in the household. If a family has one boy and one girl, and they can only afford to send one of them to school, they will actually send the little girl to school rather than the little boy. So this is a society where it's just about reverse from what we have in the Western world. Now, what we've done in this society is we've gone and we've run simple experiments. And what we find in this society is that women are actually more competitive than men. In fact, the Kasi women act a lot like American men, and the Kasi men act a lot like American women. So what we argue is that much of the gender difference that we observe in modern economies is because of very important societal influences. Society every day tells us how we should behave and how we should act. And when you look at other societies that give women more of a chance to display their true preferences, what you find is that women are indeed very competitive. It's just that society needs to give them the okay to express those competitive tendencies.
Well, John List, I thank you so much for joining us and for your new book, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. I thank you.
Ian, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with John List, who is a professor of economics and chairman of the Department of Economics at the University of Chicago. He's been a research associate at the National Bureau of Economics for more than a decade and served as senior economist on the President's Council of Economic Advisors for Environmental Resource Economics. He's the co-author of the new book, just out, The Y-Axis, Hidden Motives and the Undiscovered Economics of Everyday Life. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time.